Welcome, everybody. I think most of you are, we've met here before, but I'm Nicole LeBlanc, Director of Markets and Tariff. Thanks for joining us today for our Balkan Regional engagement. I hope everyone's doing safe and well in these ever-changing times. I'm going to share a couple quick introductory remarks, turn it over to Jordan, and then come back and set a bit more context for the day. But just to, as context today, we're really going to be reporting back to you, providing you an update of really what we heard out of our session in November, where various parties presented proposals and what we're continuing to explore and work through, and what you should expect to come in early 2021. So as a reminder, if we could go to the next slide, Claudia. ISO is obligated under the Freedom of Information Act to collect, gather, and disseminate information, and that does include, today we will be gathering personal information through the audio recording that's being created. And so if you have any concerns with your personal information being how it may be treated under the FOIP requirements that ISO works under, please make sure to let us know, and the contact information of how to get in touch is included on the slide here. And on the next slide, I think we are all working and operating under the kind of continued COVID restrictions and increased restrictions that we're facing just earlier this week. But you should just continue to expect that ISO will be running its engagements and all of its meetings through virtual avenues. There's no in-person activities happening anywhere for anyone, really. Before I hand it over to Jordan to run through logistics, just a quick set of introductions for the ISO folks that are here today. And as again, you're likely familiar with a lot of our faces here, but besides myself, Nicole LeBlanc, Director of Markets and Tariff, Jordan Ludwig is here from STACT to support us in facilitating the session today and getting some good dialogue and conversation going. Presentations are going to be made by Spencer Hall, Senior Tariff Design Advisor at the ISO, LaRonda Papworth, Manager of Tariff, as well as Steve Waller, Senior Design Advisor. We also have some supporting folks on the call with us here today. Carla, Claudia, and Janice are helping us run all the logistic parts of the session. So welcome, everybody. And now I'm just going to turn it over to Jordan to run through Zoom logistics, and then I'll be back for a few more opening remarks.
Thanks, Nicole. If you can move forward one slide there, Claudia. I think most have been through this before, but if it's your first time, bear with us. So we want to get a bit of a discussion going today as best as we can within the virtual setting. Most of you are going to, well, everyone that's not on the ISO side of the fence is going to be listening in listen-only mode. So when you do want to get involved, you raise your hand or use the chat box. And our preference is obviously for more of the complex questions to do more of the raise hand function, and we'll get a bit more of the back and forth as opposed to the typed into the chat box. When you are unmuted on your end, please start by just saying your name and the organization that you work with before asking your question or making your statement for it. The way that you signal to us that you want to raise your hand is down in your tray within your Zoom panel. You can see a little hand icon. Go ahead and hit that now if you can, just to show me that most of you have found it. We'll go through some more specific instructions in a second. Perfect. See folks coming online. That's great. You can throw those down now. Most of you have found it. So that just signals to me, I'm going to be monitoring that you'd like to get into the fray for it. And we'll do our best to prioritize that as we go. If you can go forward, one question as well, or one page rather, Claudia. And just some more instructions if you're on your smartphone or your 2-in-1, where that hand is. I'm sure most of you are Zoom pros by now, and well-equipped to find it. If you can go forward one more. and using, if you're accessing this via a conference call, the way this works is you hit *9 and that signals to us that you'd like to ask a question, raise your hand. We'll unmute you on our end, and then you have to also hit *6 to unmute yourself on your end, and then you'll be on the screen ready to ask your questions. So that's how that process works. If you can go forward one more. So for the day, and this is nothing new for it, we're going to ask that everyone listen to each other's perspectives, and keep this respectful, balance those conversations fairly, and keep an open mind when we're having any bit of the conversation. It's nothing new from that end. And with that, I would hand it back over to Nicole. If you can go forward one more slide, Claudia. Nicole, do you want me to continue going through the purpose and objectives for it?
And the agenda, and then I'll take over.
You bet. So today is all about continuing to build that shared understanding of the themes, and specifically start to understand a little bit more where the areas of agreement and disagreement are, and just make sure that there's a conversation about those. So the specific objectives, it's understanding the common themes, where folks are aligned across the proposals and where they're not aligned, and why those discrepancies are. And we're going to introduce the mitigation conversation a little bit more wholesomely. If you can go forward for the agenda, what you'll see here is there's a number of different groups and breaks throughout the day. Conversation topics, rather, where we're going to be introducing folks from the ICE are going to be introducing what's been heard up until now, kind of the key takeaways from that, and then we can have a bit of a discussion on it. So we're going to see that kind of iterative theme emerge throughout the day, with a nice half hour break there mid morning to make sure that everyone can go recharge, use the bathrooms, get more coffee, etc. Perfect. Over to you now, Nicole.
Thanks, Jordan. So on slide 12, the kind of the parties or companies that are registered today are listed out, and you can see as we have normally been having, we've got a pretty broad spectrum of the industry listening in and participating today. So that's great. It does highlight the importance of this topic for many people in the industry. I also do want to note, as we have in the past, the Alberta Utilities Commission is attending today, and they've asked me to again just read a brief note around their participation, and so I'm going to do that now. So from the AUC, thank you for inviting the AUC staff to the technical meeting on these matters. Similar to previous Vulcan Regional Tariff Design consultation sessions held, the commission will participate in these meetings through the attendance of staff. The AUC envisions the team being involved in the technical session mostly as a learning opportunity. The AUC staff are not here as AUC decision makers, nor to act as a proxy for any decision of the AUC panel in any of its decisions relating to these issues or resulting proceedings. To the extent that comments are required as part of the ISO's consultation, any comments from the AUC technical staff would be made publicly provided. And given that the AUC has limited staff, some of the staff present today will be assigned as staff to future proceedings that deal with these or related matters. And if anyone has concerns at any time with staff attending, please let the AUC know, and as they will need to withdraw from participating in these technical meetings. So shifting over to the kind of the slide, I think it's probably 14, relating to the stakeholder engagement framework that the ISO's operating under or looking to operate to create. Oh, back on 14, we do continue to hold it important that we are running inclusive, strategic, and meaningful engagements, and engaging to understand the broad needs and interests across this group, which is a pretty broad group, is really important to us. And we want to make sure that we're providing clarity around what our objectives are, what we're trying to achieve, and then provide tools and information to parties to assess what the implications of the potential changes that we're talking about here mean to them. We want to also strive to build, this is probably getting into the next slide, Claudia, slide 15, also make sure that we're building shared understanding of where there's agreement as well as disagreement relating to this file, so that we can support regulatory the regulatory process that we'll be shifting into in 2021 by sharing information with the AUC to make sure that they're understanding or able to narrow to the key issues quickly. If we switch over to slide 16, which lays out the sequence of sessions that we are running through with this process. So today, as you've heard, we're going to be kind of, and I'll talk about this a bit more, reporting back on what we've heard and providing more information around the next steps relating to mitigation following today. The next stages will really be in February. We'll be coming back with a design proposal for Balkan regional rates that we'll be seeking feedback on, as well as much more detailed information around the mitigation plan or path to address rate impacts for parties under the proposal, which LaRonda will be talking about in further detail today. We'll be kind of cycling through, I think, a couple or providing the proposal, as well as looking to provide tools and technical information for people to be able to evaluate the proposal and then talk through or work through the mitigation components of the proposal going forward. Then in April, we would be coming back for one sort of final check-in prior to filing the application, showing where the final proposal landed, as well as the final mitigation path or proposal as well. Switching gears into kind of the next section of the presentation around opening remarks, if you want to take us down to slide 19, Claudia. I want to pause here very deliberately and acknowledge the amount of efforts and contributions that have been made from all the parties that are involved in the engagement so far. It's tremendously helpful for us in making sure that we're understanding the kind of the full breadth of issues, the full breadth of options, considerations, and implications, and all through all of it, your proposals, your responses, your concerns, and commentary at the sessions that we're having, as well as in written exchange of information, it all contributes to us expanding our understanding of the challenges, the issues, the implications, and enabling us to build a proposal that is going to better suit all of Alberta. And so thank you very much. It's very important to us, and we look to have you continue to engage and contribute. Then switching over into the next slide, I do want to spend a few minutes here and acknowledge and recognize that we are hearing there are concerns with the pace that we're progressing this initiative, and those concerns are actually coming on both sides of the coin of that we are moving too fast, or now is not the time to be progressing this initiative, as well as that we're going too slow and that this is dragging on for too long. And so what I want to communicate is that we are continuing the progress and the pace that we'd laid out with our engagement plan that I just ran through, and the target of filing the application with the commission by the end of June 2021. But want to share information here today to look to address some of those concerns. One part of the information being around sharing more information around why we see there is an important case for change here, and that it's important that the ISO continue to advance this design consideration, as well as share more information around what our plan is for mitigation to make sure that we're building confidence or it's understood that we want to address the concerns related to future rate impacts. Touching on both of those a little bit more around the case for change and our plans for mitigation, Spencer's going to talk through later during this morning, really provide some more background or information around why what we're seeing as issues and what's driving our push to continue to investigate changes to the Balkan regional design. But at its core, it's really that one of the key cost drivers, the Balkan regional design that's recovered through 12CP signals, is out of step with the costs that are being driven and the kind of the incentive or the signal that the 12CP response is sending. They're not in step. They're driving behaviors that do not result in system-wide cost reductions and instead are resulting in cost shifting. And we think this is an issue that to ensure long-term sustainability of the rate design is something that needs to be addressed. But we also recognize, as we've said many times, that there are parties that have made investment decisions based on the rates that are in place today. And the path to transition does need to account for these investments that have been made and the implications to these parties. And that's why we've got a large focus in our design around how to develop an implementation path or an implementation path that includes maybe transitionary steps as well as mitigation aspects that make sure that as we're looking towards that longer term rate design that we're looking to achieve, how do we get there or step there in a way that's minimally disruptive to consumers? And this aspect of making sure that consumers are not unduly burdened with an impact is something that there is strong agreement on across this group. Each one of the proposals that was presented in November, including ISO's, does acknowledge that there's none of us will be better off, or the system will not be better off if there are less consumers on the system. And so as we go through this rate change, there needs to be an acknowledgement and kind of that issue needs to be addressed. And we'll talk about that a little bit later as well when we're talking about the areas of agreement. And we do think we can find such a path, and we're going to be talking about the levers or the tools that we think are available today. And then, as I mentioned, also talk about the process in which we're going to work with impacted parties as well as the broader group in 2021 to move forward in that place once we've landed the rate proposal. So coming back to just maybe the objectives and the fact that we are continuing to progress, we are very well aware that we are moving in a very challenging and uncertain time. Even earlier this week, I think we all probably personally took a bit of a hit of, okay, what does this mean? What does this mean for us personally? And then as an industry and as a province, where are we going to be in 2021, 2022, 2023, when these rates come into effect? But the ISO has been investigating this issue for the past 3 years. And there's been many uncertainties in that time period as well. And we do think it's important to continue to progress, that the issue exists, and there's a need to set us on a long-term path that will enable more sustainable cost recovery in the province for the long term. And that it's important to bring some closure to this issue and not let it continue to linger. So we are going to be continuing to push forward, noting that we want the mitigation and finding a path of implementation that's minimally disruptive is of critical importance to us. And before I close, I just do also want to note that, as many of you are likely aware, the DOE has initiated an engagement related to self-supply and export. And ISO will be closely involved in that engagement. I think some parties that would say that we are moving too fast even before this engagement was announced would suggest that this is another reason that we should pause. ISO does not share that view. We, as we would have noted in our submission to the commission through the self-supply and export process, the ISO does, we support parties having as many choices as they could on how they get their, meet their energy needs, and kind of are in support of what would be unlimited self-supply and export. But we also acknowledged that there were two very important aspects that also had to go along with any changes to allow unlimited self-supply and exports, and those related to tariff treatment as well as market visibility and market transparency. And in the aspect of tariff treatment, shifting to a world where there is unlimited self-supply and export becomes available, it creates even more importance to progress with the work that we're looking at in this design phase and ensuring that rates enable fair and reasonable cost recovery and wouldn't lead to further cost shifting. And so we see it as kind of an important parallel step for us to be continuing this design work as the government looks to evaluate and engage any policy changes or implement any policy changes related to self-supply and export. Those are my opening remarks that kind of set the context for the day. We'll look to be giving you information around what we took away from the proposals, themes that we're continuing to explore relating to rate design and mitigation, some additional information around our view of the case for change. And just in closing, I'll acknowledge that you're not going to walk away today with all the answers. At the end of this session, there are going to be outstanding questions because we have outstanding work to do. And what we're looking to do is give you visibility on where we landed, where we have landed things, and where we have continual exploration and evaluations to do, and what you should expect to see from us in the coming months in February and April. So with that, I thanks for your time.
Thanks very much, Nicole, and good morning, everyone. It's my pleasure to talk to you today about some of the things we heard from our last session and the themes that we're taking away from that and the learnings that we had from that. So we're going to start off just with a bit of review from what we saw and what we heard in our last session. So we can go to slide 22 for those of you on the phone. These are the proposals that we received on November 5th and that we heard. And so there's a number of groups that presented proposals on that session. And just to reiterate on Nicole's comment, you know, we recognize it takes a lot of work to put these together. And it's clear there was a lot of good discussion and thinking that went into preparing them. So thanks very much to all of those who presented. We did hear some feedback that we should group the proposals into kind of different categories around the bulk and regional rate design and the energy storage proposals. And so that's what we've done today. We do think there are some cross-cutting issues between both of these aspects. So part of the goal is to foster the conversation between those two different kind of interests. But for today, we're going to talk about one and then the other. So Steve will walk us through the energy storage treatment proposals a little bit later today. With that, I think we can dive right in. So our bulk and regional proposals, we've used this diagram to try to capture some of the key elements in different proposals. And we presented something similar like this for the ISO's bookends A and B. And part of the feedback we received from that is that we were missing a category in our spectrum. So we've added that. And just for those of you who may not have seen that, we have four different billing methods, you might say. So we have on the left-hand side, we have contract capacity at the top. We have coincident peak or single hour type of charges on the bottom. And then on the right, we have the per site charges and the energy charges. And we've divided these up. We got some feedback on how to kind of divide these up into which ones are responsive or encourage customers to change behavior and which ones have kind of a broad focus versus a more targeted focus. So we've mapped the bookends A and B on there, and we've added the two proposals from the two presenting groups there that recommended certain changes, and we'll dive into what those look like in a little bit more detail in the next piece. And then we have the current state as well identified. And the one that we couldn't figure out a way to put the Suncor proposal on, and the reason is it combines a number of these different elements into their proposal. And so we had a hard time figuring out where it should fit on this, which is more a limitation of the diagram, and not, it has nothing to do with the proposal. So with that, we can dive into a little bit more on the details on our slide 24. So there's a lot of information here. It's not meant to be overwhelming, but we did want to try to capture all these different aspects in one place. So we'll walk through it just to go through kind of a review of what we've heard. So the first column on the left-hand side there is the charge. So this is basically the way we're collecting costs. And we have four different categories identified, and those correspond to those four different circles on the previous diagram. So these are the demand charge or billing capacity, which is a customer's non-coincident peak charge. The peak charge is really that idea of coincident peak, so system peak or regional peak. Then we have the energy charge, which is, you know, one we are probably all more familiar with, the dollar per megawatt hour type of charge. And the last one is that customer or per site charge, which is kind of a fixed charge for having a connection for all customers. So we've mapped the proposals into how they correspond to these different buckets. So starting with the status quo, we have our allocation between bulk and regional charges displayed there. So regional charges, we collect 90% of the revenue on our demand charge and 10% on the energy. On the bulk system, we're collecting 93% of our costs on the coincident system peak and 7% on energy. This was a proposal that we heard from one of our presenters, and so they recommended staying with the status quo. And that was DUC, ADC. And we want to recognize that that's one of the proposals we heard, is also to stick with the status quo. The other bookends that we presented earlier in the stakeholder engagement process are bookends A and B. So these are basically attributing different amounts of cost to these different charges. So in bookend A, the simplest, you know, 100% of those costs are collected on our demand, our customer non-coincident peak charge, and nothing on the other three types of charges. Bookend B, we have this concept of dividing up our costs between intra-regional and inter-regional portions. And so that's would split up the amount of cost that's collected between the demand and regional peak charges. So that's all review. And then we get into our alternatives. So alternative D was presented by the CCA. And this is basically preserving the cost categorization of the status quo, but moving the amount of costs that are collected on the system peak to a unratcheted non-coincident peak or demand charge. So the one change you'll see there is just that shift from bulk 93% moving from peak to demand. We also have alternative C, which is, I think these are actually reversed now that I'm looking at this again. Alternative C is, as it's shown here, monthly non-coincident peak charge, which is set in a marginal or incremental fashion. So the collection of cost on the demand charge is set in this incremental method. So that's basically calculating the amount of cost that would be saved from a change in demand or incurred from an increase in demand. And we'll get into how that works a little bit later. And the remainder is collected on the ratcheted non-coincident peak. Nothing is collected on the other types of charges. And I think, just to go back to that, I think alternative D and alternative C should be swapped here. So we might have to fix that. In the case of Suncor, the proposal is again using an incremental or marginal approach. And so this one has a couple more elements that we heard. And basically this relates to an improvement on the regional concept in bookend B. And this has to do with determining really the relationship between region demand and supply and attributing a marginal cost to that influence. And so the each charge, so the demand and the peak, whether it's tied to coincident inflows or coincident demand, is calculated in this marginal way. And those charges then set the amount of costs that are recovered on each of those categories. The remainder, so what's left over to collect, is billed on the customer or per site charge. And so that gives the ability to recover all the transmission costs. That's a lot of information. I know it's a lot to take in. The next slide tries to summarize kind of the main themes that we identified through those proposals. And so the first one, I think, you know, it's really important just to recognize that we have heard from different stakeholders that are it's up to the ISO basically to make a case for changes. And there's really two aspects to this. One is really the timing. So now is not the time for change. And Nicole has briefly talked already about that, about why we think we need to keep progressing this long-term. And the second aspect is that there are no issues with the current rate design. And so that's something that we do want to get into in a little bit more detail later today. The changes that we saw relative to the status quo, so the folks that made proposals for changes to the status quo, really boiled down to, you know, how we're allocating costs to those different billing determinants and whether we have the right proportions. And that was in, you know, two proposals relating to allocating more of the bulk costs to the billing capacity charge, as well as the idea of changing how the ratchets work. And so changes to which of those are ratcheted and which of those are unratcheted. And just a reminder, the concept of ratchet really means, you know, when your own use sets a peak, how long does that last in the billing cycle? So right now we have a 2-year ratchet. If we had a monthly charge with no ratchet, your use in 1 month wouldn't affect your peak own use in the next month. The other theme was really around extending from system to regional coincident peak. And this had to do with having a more precise method to do so that really is more reflective of how the system works and how both demand and generation relate to stress on the transmission system. And the final element that we heard was really around the approach to cost allocation and this idea of calculating marginal or incremental cost of transmission savings from changes in load response and using that to set rates, which is a bit of a different approach. And it's one that we think it's important to recognize as an option that that we've have heard about and want to explore a bit more. So I think that sums up what we heard and where we're at in our understanding of that. And we do want to take a moment. I know that was pretty brief and quick, so I'd like to take some questions. I'm not sure, Jordan, if you see anyone's hands or...
Yeah, we can start with Raj. We'll get Raj's side unmuted.
Hi, Spencer. Thanks. If you go to slide 24, I need to get my glasses.
We had to make the font a bit smaller to fit it all.
So under alternative D, there were two other things that were mentioned. One is I too mentioned the fact that, or rather the proposal that we should give consideration to setting the NCP demand charges based on marginal costs. So that was one factor. And then the any remaining would go to billing capacity. So it would be a connection charge based on billing capacity. And that would be a differentiated billing capacity charge. So those are two clarifications I thought I might suggest.
Okay, thanks very much.
Any other questions on the summary? Let's get Robert unmuted. And again, just a reminder, if you could also state your organization's name when you come online. Robert, are you wanting to get in, or was that a flippant hand raise, an accidental one? There we go.
Sorry about that. Good morning, everybody. My name's Robert Stewart. I'm with RMP Energy Storage. What I notice and wonder about is when we go to slide, I think it was slide 23, this is all, again, I think, assuming that all load customers are looking for the same firm service, there's no way to, within this picture, I don't see a way to separate firm and non-firm load customers. And I wanted to understand if that was something that we could look at trying to change allow us to look at everyone within the same sort of bucket. So that was my sort of comment and question was, it doesn't look like we can put people as non-firm customers here, and how can we do that?
Okay, thanks for that. I think it's, you know, a really fair point. And I think it's a limitation of what we're trying to do. This is super conceptual and not meant to be, you know, represent everything that we need to consider. But if you have suggestions or you can see a way to do that, you can definitely let us know and we'll try to accommodate that. I think, you know, it's meant to kind of illustrate a broad perspective, and then we'll drill down into more targeted or focused concepts. But it's certainly, you know, point taken, and we'll look for some suggestions if you have some.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robert.
Anyone else with their hand up, Jordan, or we can move on?
There's Hal. Let's get Hal unmuted. Hey, Hal.
Hey. So this is Hao Liu from AutoLink. If we're looking at slide 23, and probably let's go 24, I guess, is probably So now just kind of the Spencer, you said that there's probably a C and D is a little bit switched. So so if we're looking at alternative C, so it's really that there are some kind of the a little kind of uncertainty here. It's like a, if we're looking at our alternative C, it's a build around like the assumption about kind of the 2018 tariff as was kind of the approved by the commission, the kind of the, that kind of the basic structure. And there is a complexity there, like right now, like because 2018 tariff is based on the metering change practice, which is goes with that 2018 design. And we understand is R&V going on that kind of metering practice. So so that would be probably like a, if this is a really going into the gross metering, net metering, how that metering practice may come into the play. So that would be that like a, some of the implication will be probably having like depending on R&V like decisions will have some implications for that C kind of consideration in the C. So just want to flag that for you guys.
Okay, thank you. No, that's a helpful comment.
Seeing a question from Chris Bess. Let's get Chris unmuted. Hey, Chris.
Hi, it's Chris Bess, Best Consulting Solutions. Just wanted to refer back to, I guess, slide 20. You talked about the Government of Alberta's self-supply and export policy. That's just kind of come out of the blue in this consultation. I don't think it's been discussed recently. My recollection is the last thing on that came last summer when the AUC promoted the discussion paper that they had provided to the government. Has there been any developments on that since then that we should know about or that are impacting this?
I'll let Nicole respond to that.
The government of Alberta initiated a meeting with, I think they'd identified a broad range of parties to invite to that meeting. It occurred last week, and they, at that point, disclosed that they are running an engagement over the next month or so that involves two workshop meetings and a survey. So that's what we were referring to here. I believe they will be loading that survey up onto their own webpage, but that's, I can look into that and see what I can find between now and 12:30 and close the loop if I have any other information there.
Yeah, I guess my invite must be lost in the mail. Yeah, if you could post anything on that or let us know, you know, if there's something that you can release to those of us who didn't get an invite, or just at least so we know what's going on. I don't expect to be invited, but I would like to be up to date or be able to track it.
Yeah, so the ISO, we won't be posting anything relating to that engagement, but what I will just take a look to let you know if they do plan to post the survey on their own webpage.
Okay, I'll take a look. Thanks.
Thanks, Chris. Any other questions on summary and what was heard up until now? Jeff, I saw you'd kind of had your voice in the chat box before looking for clarity on this. Do you feel like your questions are answered, or it's Jeff Lester? Hey, Jeff.
Hey, yeah, I'm good. We're clearly in the camp of, what we have not seen yet to date is the, is the quantitative analysis, and I get that it sounds like it may be coming today, at least in part, to show, first of all, why the change is necessary, and second of all, whether it's going to create the solution that is, is what we're potentially after, when what I think we clearly heard from several customer groups is this causes a materially negative impact to employers while resulting in an extra cup of coffee a month for residential consumers. So I just think we need to be careful as we get into this. That's kind of our take on it.
Okay, thanks, Jeff. Surendra, I see your hands up.
Hey, hi, good morning all.
Good morning.
Can you go to the slide 23 again, where you have that, well, this graph, even though it's very simple, have its limitation, but it's very clearly indicate that we need to move to the corner where you have more response and cover this specific application. But what we're doing here, we are moving away from the corner where we need to be. Like, I mean, we already near the corner, which is more price responsive, more cost cohesion. It passed all those criteria, except because cost has gone so high. And because of the cost have gone so high, we are throwing away all these established economical cost cohesion principle and moving away from this corner doesn't make any sense, but that's what we're doing.
Okay. We'll absolutely accept that as input, and thanks for that comment for now, Surrender Fort. I think if there's no other questions on just clarification on the ISO's kind of summary here, we'll probably move on to the next and continue to peel back this onion and see what other information that we can start to unwind where we're heading and where there's areas of agreement and disagreement. So back over to you, Spencer.
Yeah, thanks, Jordan. I think those last two comments are a really good segue into what we want to talk about next. And those are, you know, different themes that we're trying to draw together into elements that we need to discuss further with you. And we've grouped them into some categories here. So there are themes that we're continuing to explore and want to understand better. And these have to do with some of the elements that we've already been talking about. And that, you know, we, as we go through this, we don't necessarily have a position today, but we recognize that we need to get there. And so we want your help to understand, you know, the best way to do that. And I think there's two main ones here that we'll talk about in a bit. So cost allocation, really whether we adopt a embedded or a marginal approach to that. For some of you, maybe those words don't mean anything. For some of you, they're probably really important and really meaningful. So we'll try to do a little bit of sharing our understanding and where we're at on these questions, in part to make sure that we all have a common understanding and then can have an informed conversation about where the trade-offs are. The energy storage tariff treatment, we'll get into following that and talk about some of the areas where we've heard and are continuing to ask questions. And then I think it's following the break, we'll get into some themes that we are not exploring and the reasons for that. And so, you know, we've just been talking about this idea of kind of why we don't think the status quo is a reasonable or sustainable approach to carry us forward in the future. And, you know, what that actually means and some of the thinking that we've done on that topic. And we'll also talk a little bit about whether we want to add additional complexity or not. And we've landed on not adding additional complexity at this time. So these themes, I think, will answer some questions, certainly provoke more. And we are trying to put some of these questions behind us and open up new areas. So I think there'll be some uncertainty and you know, questions about where we're going with that. And that's intentional, right? We want to have that informed discussion with you. And we know that these are super important. So when we're talking about these themes, you know, around cost allocation, we know that it will have an impact, and we know that you care about that, and that matters. It matters for all of us. And so we've kind of separated out the last piece of our discussion on mitigation to achieve minimal disruption. And we put it separate because we're serious about it. And we think it matters. It's really important to how we achieve our overall tariff design objectives. And we want to talk to you about how we're planning to approach it and where there's information that we can share with you at different stages to help understand kind of where we're at in answering some of the questions that we're going to talk about first. So as we go through this, I think some of it is going to be very theoretical, and we know it has a very real material impact, but we want to try to have the theoretical or the open, frank conversation separately. And we know that whatever decision we make will need to find a path that's going to work as best we can. And we want to try to do that. So it might be a tall order to ask, but that's the spirit that I think we should approach this today. So with that, we'll get into cost allocation and the different methods that we've heard. So we have heard, just going back to kind of the proposals that we walked through, two real fundamental approaches to cost allocation. And really this has to do with answering that question about how much of the cost are we collecting on each billing determinant. And the embedded approach is the first approach, and that's what we're using today. The marginal or incremental approach is kind of this alternative that's being proposed. And so, you know, for folks who don't think about transmission tariffs day and night, this might be a little bit theoretical or a little bit of a opportunity for learning. And for those of you who do think about this all the time, you know, let's try to make sure that we all have this common understanding as we talk about these questions. So the embedded approach is kind of the classic cost allocation methodology, and that's what we have in place today with our current tariff. And it's really centers around answering this question about how the use of the network is related to the cost of the network and establishing that relationship through some different types of analysis. So our current methodology for this was developed through our 2014 tariff application. In 2018, we updated the inputs for that approach. And we have heard from stakeholders that we should update this study. And we want to spend a bit of time talking about this because updates to that study could take a number of different forms. And so I think it's important to really be clear about what it is we're talking about. Turning to the marginal or incremental approach, this is kind of a different approach to the question of how to allocate costs to billing determinants. And it's really trying to answer this question of, you know, what is the incremental cost of supplying one more unit of demand, or what is the cost savings from reducing demand by one unit? Those are kind of the same ways of looking at this problem of, you know, what is the relationship between a change in demand and the change in cost? Once you've answered that question, the next question is how do you collect the remainder of the revenue requirement? And within this approach, you know, that's the concept is to do that in a way that tries to not distort other decisions, but don't want to get ahead of myself. So we recognize this is a shift from our historical rate design approach and cost allocation approach. But because, you know, we did hear about it in two different stakeholder proposals, we do think it's worth exploring this further. And I think it's fair to say, like, this is a bigger question. And, you know, certainly in some of the feedback we've heard from our session two, we heard that, you know, this was really important for folks to understand this cost allocation question. So I think that, you know, the timing that we're getting to it, you know, some folks may think it's too late, or some folks may think, you know, they're we're really just getting to the core issues, and hopefully we can have a constructive conversation about this today. So let's jump in and talk about the embedded approach. And again, this might be review. So slide 31 is really looking at our 2014 cost causation study that really tried to establish this relationship between the concept of a minimum system needed to serve load and then the optimal system. And this kind of approach is based on this concept of having, the smallest system possible to connect customers, which is allocated to the demand charges, and then the optimized system, which has to do with reducing the losses on that system allocated to the energy charges. And, you know, there's a lot of material on this. If you're curious, you can take a look at the cost allocation study from 2014. But really, I think this concept is really just to illustrate how this is done currently. And on our next slide, we get into how these cost allocations are, how they work in practice. And if you took a look at this slide previously, we did make a small update just in the categorization of bulk and regional by voltage. So if that made no sense, then you probably didn't look at this previously, and that's fine. So this is illustrating how we apply the minimum system approach to go from our overall revenue requirement to the proportions that we're collecting on each billing determinant or each type of charge. So the first step is really this voltage functionalization between bulk and regional that sets the portion of costs in each of those buckets. Then we use this minimum system approach to allocate or to classify those costs between demand and energy, and that's for both of the regional and the bulk buckets. And then those allocations then are reflected, if you follow the math, in the portion of costs that we're recovering on each of those billing determinants. So these are where the allocations are coming from, basically. And you'll note that the math doesn't add up to 100% just because pod costs are not shown in this. So that's another 25% approximately. I know that's probably a lot of information, so we'll pause here. And if you have a clarifying question, we can take it. But if not, we can go into...
One question here, Spencer. Okay. Raj, Raj Sharma's put up.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Hi, this is Raj Sharma from Nextera Insights. So I would like to point out one thing that may not be apparent. So the cost causation study gave you the function and classes, but it did not really give you the rate design. So there are two distinct steps to go from function and classes to rate design. First, you have demand and energy costs, but you don't have to follow that in rate design. So you can create the cost buckets out of those, but you don't have to allocate demand to rate design on demand. So that's the first step, I guess. And then the second choice is, what kind of demand, right? CP or NCP or ratcheted or whatever that number is. So there are two steps to go from function and classes to rate design, which wasn't really part of the study. It was more done by the ISO.
Okay, thanks. That's a good point, actually, and one to keep in mind is, you know, these proportions of charges don't necessarily need to reflect that cost allocation step. So the two steps, I mean, We're trying to keep this from being overwhelming, but that is a good clarification. So thank you. Let's jump into the next slide. And this, I think, is really related to this idea of updates to the cost causation study, because, you know, as we went through these different steps, there are different ways that an update could occur and different aspects of that could change or be reconsidered, let's say. And so there's different ways to have functional alternatives selected. So right now we have this voltage functionalization, but you know, in our bookend B, we propose this intra and inter-regional functionalization. There's also recognition that there's other ways to do it, right? And we're not trying to list them all here. This isn't meant to be exhaustive, but it's really about identifying those areas where there are questions or where there are ideas from you folks on what we can do to update this. The same can be said for classification. So there's different ways to do that as well, including, you know, the one that we're using today, which is the minimum system. And, you know, these are actually drawn from the 2014 study that is available. So I don't need to go into the detail on them. If you're interested, you can find that in that study. But we do just want to put this out as something that we're, you know, continuing to work on and continuing to try to understand the options and the trade-offs and how they will help us meet our rate design objectives. So that's the embedded approach. And thank you for bearing with me through that. And we'll jump into marginal approach next. So the next slide, 34, is a marginal approach. And this I've borrowed from the regulatory assistance project. Actually put out a report earlier this year called something like Cost Allocation Methods for the 21st Century. So this is a quote really from them, but it's we're trying to illustrate this idea that we've heard in stakeholder proposals around marginal approach to cost allocation. So the fundamental principle is prices should reflect current or future costs. And they should do that so that the value today of the resources that are being used are reflected in the incentives and choices that customers face. And so this is a bit of a different approach in setting cost allocation in that you're working kind of backwards from, okay, this is the price that meets certain criteria, and then how much of the revenue requirement is covered by charging that price. The remainder then needs to be collected in a way that doesn't distort the other incentives that you're creating in the charging design. So hopefully that's a helpful way to think about this. Obviously there's pros and cons with both the embedded and the marginal. So there's, you know, upsides and downsides of this marginal approach. We're not saying it's the golden solution necessarily, but it is, you know, important that I think we talk about this and understand the ideas that are behind this. So to illustrate this a bit better, on slide 35, we have, you know, something that you... If you haven't dusted off your economics textbook in a while, this might be on one of the pages. And it's really trying to illustrate how you would think about developing this marginal cost concept. And the idea is really, you know, looking at how a change in capacity that is serving one more customer or one more megawatt is changing the cost. And so you look at kind of the additional capacity that you're adding relative to where you are today and using that as a proxy for the marginal cost of the transmission. And as I mentioned, it's kind of starting from what is that price signal and working backwards to cost recovery, and then using the, you know, revenue you're collecting on that, the difference between the marginal and the average cost needs to be recovered to minimize distortions to the extent we can. There's kind of two different ways you could think about this if it helps to have a concrete example in your mind. You know, one way is in kind of a micro way, we might think about a slightly larger transmission line. And so going from, you know, a transmission line that can serve, you know, one unit of capacity to two is kind of that change that would be reflected in that increment of capacity. And then the cost to do so is that marginal cost. It may not scale up, or it may be difficult to scale that up. So if we look at a more macro view, we can think about the change in load growth that is accommodated from a change in the transmission system. And both of these concepts, you know, rely on assumptions and inputs and things of that nature. So, you know, it's not to say that that's the final answer, but that's really just to illustrate the concept. The next slide, 36, we tried to list out some options. And because, you know, we're not using this today, it's a little bit more high level. And, you know, we're trying to put these ideas out here, not necessarily to say that one is better than any other. But, you know, we did hear a concept about using long-run transmission costs divided by long-run planned load growth to calculate that marginal rate, where kind of that long run is, you know, 6 years or long enough to include changes in the economy and changes in, you know, the lumpiness of investment in transmission. And using this least distortionary cost recovery on and applying that to, or achieving that by applying that charge to a per site or customer charge. The idea being that, you know, a charge that applies the same to all customers, regardless of how they use the system, is not going to distort their other choices to use energy or use the grid. There's other approaches. So I talked a little bit about the macro approach or the micro approach on the previous slide. Again, that, you know, these are theoretical or hypothetical, maybe I should say. You could take a look at the future plan costs and plan load growth to calculate that proxy for the marginal cost. You could look at actual costs and actual load growth. You could refine it down to look at the portion of transmission projects where load is identified as a driver. All of these are different, you know, ways I think we could try to untangle this cost allocation problem in this way. So that's a high level summary. We're exploring this theme, and we want to understand what considerations we should account for in these, you know, two different approaches, and what our options are. So I think now we'll take some questions.
So Paula, I saw, had her hand up for a bit of time, and she started on again. I know she also put a question to the Q&A, so let's start with Paula.
Jordan, you've got some weird audio issue going on. Maybe.
That sounds pretty distorted.
Still not good?
That's much better. Crystal clear.
All right. Let's start with Paula.
So I had one of the questions is, you refer back to the 2014 study, and I was just wondering, that's what, 6 years old, probably the data before it was maybe a couple years before or a year before, so 7 years old. Do you know if it's still relevant?
That's a very good question. And it's one that we will touch on a little bit later on today. But I think, you know, that's a really important question. It is important to recognize that transmission is a long-term, you know, it's a long-term game, and we make investments for the long-term. They're used over a long period of time. So, you know, I think in a lot of other cases, you know, in our energy market, 7 years is a lifetime. In transmission, it's a little bit harder to come out and make that conclusion quite so readily. The last time we did an update to this study was in 2018. So we did use updated information at that time. And, you know, we found some results that actually didn't seem to make sense at that time. But, you know, certainly it's being considered. So that was 2 years ago. It's probably using data from 2017. So could you make an argument that that's no longer relevant, perhaps, but I think it's a good question. And as we look at how we make our approach sustainable, we definitely do, you know, are looking for a method that does, you know, update to our current state and in whatever shape that takes.
And just to follow on with that, so it would be up to the ISO to determine whether or not that study is still relevant and what metrics it would use to confirm its relevancy. Like, that's a task for the ISO to do?
Yes.
Sorry. Okay. My second question, we have a lot of the bulk of our conversation is about the calculation methodology, but not a lot of it is on the location of measurement. Where do you measure for this? Do you measure where transmission meets distribution? Do you measure at the end user? Do you measure at a branch? Where is the measurement? I know California did there was some push and pull, but there was a lot of transparent discussion on where is this measured? Is it measured at the end user? Is it measured, they called it, there was two, one was at the end user, one was more like at the neighborhood or at the branch. So has there been thought put out there for the location of measurement, the definition of an end user, about where exactly are you measuring this? Because I know California spent, you know, almost a year on this very topic, and it seems not to be part of our conversation. And I'm just wondering, can we spend some time on that and have a discussion in a transparent manner? And I know that we still need all the discussion on the methodology for the calculations, but can we be transparent and clear on where we measure and where this point is actually calculated? If that makes any sense.
Yeah, I just want to clarify one aspect. Is it the point of measurement for the purpose of this, the cost allocation and that?
Yes.
Or is it the point of measurement for how customers are billed with the bulk and regional rates?
Yes. Yes. And I think that should be part of the conversation is for those.
Sorry, is it the first or the second or both?
It's both.
Okay.
So for example, in California, some of the DG argued that you need to have it at the branch level. So where distribution meets transmission is where the point should be. But they looked at sort of cost causation there and said, listen, since solar is connected and it's not offsetting peak, then we don't believe it should be at the branch. It should be at the end user. And the end user was a deliberate determination for where it should be measured, that if you are behind the meter at the end user, but not in the same branch and distribution to say, hey, listen, look at my energy is flowing around this branch, that it's not, we're not pulling from the transmission as a result. But there was this concerted discussion about where do we measure this? And I think this is an important discussion for the ISO and for the stakeholders. We're spending a lot of our time and attention on the math of how it's calculated, but not where it's calculated. And I think it needs to be there as well.
So maybe can I add into Paula's question, Spencer?
Yes, please.
So that is a topic that has been discussed and evaluated in Alberta through the 2018 GTA proceeding and a discussion around adjusted metering practice, and the ISO put forward a proposal that was looking at exactly where that metering point should be, and the commission approved our adjusted metering practice in the decision, although the implementation of it is still kind of in evaluation through a proceeding that was guided or driven from an R&B on that decision. So I'd say, Paula, that has been a discussion that Alberta had for 2-3 years now. And there's information available through that proceeding on where that's landed. The part around how that gets translated, the second part around kind of how these rates get translated into bills for consumers, is something that we had identified early days to look at, to make sure that as many customers as possible were seeing these price signals directly. Because at this point, there are many distribution connected customers that don't maybe see the 12 CP signal. And so there's maybe some opportunity to unlock some efficiencies there, but that's more in the distribution tariffs than the ISO tariff.
And so the focus is then is that we go with what was done in the last tariff for the point of where you measure where the bulk and regional tariff will be applied. And now we're just working on where it is. Would they not go together? Or is one is set and now we're just managing the other?
I think it's one is set in the sense of where is the use of the transmission system? Where's the point at which it's being used or
used.
Translated down to the distribution system? And this is more given the cost of the transmission system, how do you best or fairly allocate those costs out?
Okay, and so the idea is how do we then provide this signal to, what's that?
That I want to bring this to a close. We're running, there's other people that have questions for it to bring into the weeds a little bit. So I'll give you just 20 more seconds to kind of conclude here, Paul.
So the question is, so that's static and then we just need to manage around it. I'm just surprised that it wouldn't be done in tandem since you are essentially revising the tariff. Okay, just surprised at that.
Thank you. Let's get Horst's question in here, and then I want to move on to talk about energy storage before we're into break.
Thanks. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, good. So the first part is actually just maybe a correction. On slide 36, if you could go back at the top, you say long-run transmission cost divided by long-run planned load growth. Should that be long-run incremental transmission cost? Because to get a marginal signal, it would be delta cost divided by delta load, right?
Yes, I think that's a more accurate way. Thank you.
Just making sure that I got that it's not the whole cost. But the actual question is on slide 30, where we're talking about marginal versus embedded approach. I think we are in this situation where we are right now because people are responding to price signal. And regardless of which billing determinant we're putting or we're allocating costs to, if that charge is high for a specific billing determinant, people will look to avoid that charge by reducing that billing determinant. So I think we need to keep in mind here that whatever critique there may be for a marginal approach or whatever might be the good view behind an embedded approach is people will behave to the signal you sent them. And any cost allocation is a signal. So if we are sending a signal that is way out of sync with the benefits it provides, then we will get aberrant behavior or weird behavior that people are claiming right now that you don't get the savings from 12 CP in the order of $10,000 a megawatt, but that's the signal you're sending to the consumer. So they will spend money to avoid spending 10 grand. So they will spend up to 10 grand to avoid a signal, but the benefit isn't there. So I think it's a bit maybe misleading or kind of short-sighted to say that, oh yeah, well, marginal, we can't kind of figure it out. And there's this whole theory behind it. I think we need to look at this practical is wherever we're going to put the cost, people will respond. And is that behavior we want to see? And it doesn't matter which billing determinant you're taking, people will look at how to avoid it. So maybe taking kind of this to a close, we're looking at, or the commission has always said cost causation. And I'm kind of missing that here on the slide, because cost causation is, if I behave in a certain way, which costs am I causing? To me, that's cost causation. I think it's actually the whole marginal approach and then fixed cost recovery aligns well with findings that the commission made on losses with regard to impacts. And so I think cost causation is, basically does not align with an embedded approach. Maybe if you can comment on that, kind of how do you see cost causation fit in here?
Yeah, I think these concepts are really difficult and definitely really difficult to summarize in a concise manner, but I think you've touched on a lot of important points. We will get into the ideas around cost causation that we're thinking about a little bit later. And I think you've made some fair comments at this stage. I think it would be appropriate to move on to our next topic, but we're certainly thinking about those things and we want to talk more about them, but we'll do that a little bit later on. So thank you for that.
Okay, I see a flurry of questions in here. We are just going to park them now and move on to our next topic and see if we can't circle back to them, but appreciate the hands that are up. Let's move on to energy storage.
Hello and welcome. My name's Steve Waller and market design at the ISO. And just going to quickly walk you through what we had originally proposed back in March. And we'll go through what we'd heard from stakeholders and then cover off a little bit of where we see agreement, where we see disagreement, and what we're going to do with that information. So if we go to the next slide, then we have got it. Here's what we presented way back in March as our options to consider for energy storage. The first option was to charge energy storage based on flows, much like DTS and STS charges are applied today on whether it's the current or future tariff. Just measures of inflows, measures of outflows, and the costs be associated with those flows. The second option that we presented was modeled after the FERC 841 treatment, and as they described in that order, where DTS would only DTS-like charges would only be applied when you were not providing a service, and the services would be specifically defined by the ISO RTO, and if you were providing a particular service, the rate for transmission charges would not be applied to you, and you would be exempt from them. However, if you were not providing those services at any point in time, you would be have to pay the transmission charges for your charging and discharging energy. The third option that we presented was an interruptible service with a lower rate, since it was observed that storage could be off when the transmission system was stressed. We looked at two ways in which you could implement that, one through a direct physical control where the ISO could literally trip or activate the storage if required, and another mechanism in which you could simply issue some form of directive or dispatch to have that storage load or storage energy, whatever it was we needed, done on the system provided. So again, this is a really quick summary of the options we presented, and I'm going to do the same injustice to the stakeholder summary on the next slide. So if we go there, we heard from three different stakeholders and gave us presentations. The first one from Canria and Solus Energy Consulting, which effectively the way we interpret it was to treat storage somewhat as a transmission facility, more specifically a substation, which meant that they were really a component of the grid rather than a participant in it. However, they realized that they would be using the transmission system and would require that an ability to participate in markets. So the argument was that these resources should get a complete tariff exemption, but recognize the fact that there should be a fee to recover what we're calling the ISO's own costs in relation to managing and dispatching and dealing with the costs of storage on the system from an administrative perspective. And then from the energy trading side, yes, the storage would pay for the energy it taken off the grid, and it would be paid for the energy put back onto the grid at the corresponding prices, and would also pay the corresponding market administration fee or trading charge for those services. So that was a real quick three-bullet summary of what we heard from Canria. From Energy Storage Canada and Power Advisory, a similar treatment where storage is exempt from the tariff charges and would also pay an administration fee. They went a little further to say that, that there are services that storage can provide, much like transmission must run services when the transmission is dealing with outflow constraint problems, and could also stop consuming during inflow constraint problems. And by offering these services are in a way deferring the need for future transmission build. The third option, quickly summarized, was from RMP Energy Storage. They suggested that storage only pay the STS rate for its discharge and pay no wires costs for the charging energy, except for station service needs. So we're assuming those station service needs would be metered independently of the charging energy. Again, I'll hope to get the RMP to clarify a little bit for us here, but if that weren't the case, their alternative proposal was to allow storage to participate in an interruptible service option, where storage would be subject to a system controller directive, much like what the Power Advisory and Energy Storage Canada stated, to help relieving transmission constraint. But in the end, either an interruptible rate or an avoidance of DTS charges should be applied to storage for the RMP proposal. A slight different from the RMP proposal than the interruptible rate proposal that the ISO had laid out was that they felt this was could be broadly applied across the entire province and not locationally applied to areas where we would perceive transmission constraint. Go to the next slide. We through the discussion that we had at the last session, we did find areas of agreement. There was a lot of conversation as to whether storage was unique or not, and I think we do agree across the board that storage is not the producer or the end consumer of electric energy, nor is it the transmitter or the distributor of that energy. We also think we see agreement across the stakeholder community that energy storage can participate in a variety of ways within Alberta and what we're calling the Alberta's use cases, more specifically in energy, ancillary services, and for transmission to flow through mechanisms like energy price arbitrage, providing operating reserves, or providing non-wire solutions. The other thing where I think we see agreement is that energy should be treated in a fair, efficient, and openly competitive manner. And I don't think there's any argument there. However, there are a number of areas, if we flip to the next slide, where we see disagreement. And I've structured these in the form of questions because I think these are the questions we're ultimately going to need to answer as we progress through our tariff design. Is energy storage a user of the grid, a component of the grid, or is it both? The next question we think needs to be addressed is, does storage use the network for those Alberta-specific use cases, energy, ancillary services, transmission deferral? And also, should energy storage pay for the inflows and outflows like every other network user, or are they different enough? And they should not. And then lastly, should energy storage pay for one or more of these charges? Should it just be an administrative fee, operations and maintenance, pod charges, regional, and bulk charges? Where along this continuum should energy storage pay? In order for us to help narrow the decision for the commission, we think these questions are the ones that we need to wrestle down in our further consultations. And of course, today won't be the place where we'll be able to answer any of these. But based on the conversations that we are hearing so far, there do seem to be two polarized positions, but we think there is validity in both positions, and so we need to further explore this. So for today, though, we would like to just check that we've actually captured the positions accurately. Do you have an opinion on the answers to the questions that were just stated? And we will then take this information and continue to learn and evolve, and ultimately, through the course of the work over the next few months, develop an ISO position on this and the rationale for our position. And that really takes me to the end of our storage presentation at this point, and I'll open it up to any questions that you might have.
Let's start with Travis, and then we'll go to Evan.
Great. Am I coming through clear?
Yep, we can hear you, Travis.
So first off, Steve, thank you. That's a good summary. I think at a high level, you know, what you've put forward makes sense in our view. And I think the questions as very, very diplomatic of you in terms of the areas of disagreement. So I have three things. The first is just a general comment, which is we have not ignored, but excluded the service as a transmission asset. And I think the questions that were asked in session three, along with what you've phrased here, that service to support transmission or defer transmission is probably more difficult to be excluded than to be included in some way. And it may be outside of the tariff design and more in how does a third-party agreement with a transmitter or through the ASO contracting as part of a needs identification document storage to defer transmission in a shape or duration or whatever. I think that the main point is as you start to address some of the areas of disagreement, how storage can be a part of lowering or deferring fixed costs in the system is important. And that just kind of needs to be understood separate from the use of the grid to participate. So to your first question, I think it's both, but it depends on what they've been either contracted or in a service agreement for. So that's just a general comment. I think it needs to come in. I think the second one is, you know, very much want to kind of emphasize the agreement that storage is unique and glad to see that the ASO agrees with that. I think a lot of the issues that Elise Energy Storage Canada sees is trying to bucket with what exists today doesn't really make sense in terms of how storage is. And it is, you know, somewhat as been used before, you know, a game changer in how you have to view some of this stuff. The final one, which is more a question and recognizing you may not be able to answer now, but coming back to the ASO's options they presented and specifically the interruptible rate, it would be very informative and helpful to understand what would be composed of that interruptible rate. There are existing interruptible type rates that the ASO has. Is the ASO considering using those, or are they proposing or thinking about a new design for interruptible? And if so, what would be the cost components? I'll call it in the two buckets. One is your fixed cost that you pay to be connected to the grid and use the grid. And your second component, which is when you don't follow the interruptible rate, what's the penalty you're going to have to pay? Or call it a time of use, whatever way you want to do it. So that information would be very helpful in understanding and trying to drive towards either some sort of agreement or common consensus.
Right. And you're quite right. We won't be able to answer that question today. Absolutely, this is on the forefront of our mind about what form an interruptible rate will take and what it in itself would have a number of different structures we could propose. And we just aren't at that place quite yet.
Okay, thank you. Great.
Thank you.
I lost Jordan. Sorry, Jordan, you're muted.
My space bar is not actually working very well. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So So we're already eating into break a little bit, but I think this is important. So we're going to eat into that and kind of answer the questions for the hands that are up, and then we're going to go into break and see where the agenda lies then. So we're going to go in the order that I'm seeing them there. So Evan, then Robert, then Horst.
Great. Thanks, Jordan. I'll just, understanding that we're eating into break here, I'll just be quick. Just to go back to the summary of Canria's position, I just want to be clear. Where you have treat storage as a transmission facility or substation, I think that the substation part is the most important there. I think, you know, the way to think about the presentation that Paula gave is not that we think that storage should be transmission exclusively, but to go back to the way that that Travis framed it, you know, there are issues here with the challenge or what we're seeing with you know, a concept that tries to bucket storage with what exists. I think, you know, the way to think about us framing this as a substation is a lot of this conversation that we've had is around storage is unique because it's not quite a generator and it's not quite a load. And I think that what we were trying to emphasize there is, you know, it shares aspects with other parts of the system. And, you know, the conversation should be enlarged to be like, well, it's, you know, it shares behavior, or it shares details with load. It shares it with generation. It shares it with transmission and distribution, but it's not any one of those at the same time. So to go back to your first question where it's like, is this a component of the grid, or is it a user of the grid, or is it both? We were really trying to raise that question with that part of our presentation as well, just to open up. Let's have a bigger bucket around how we're thinking about this and think about other, you know, other types of facilities that storage is akin to, in addition to generation, in addition to load. So I just want to be clear on that. We're not endorsing treatment as transmission, but we want to greatly enlarge the conversations that we're also considering those services as well.
Thanks, Evan. Let's go Robert, and then I'm going to go to Matt, and then we're going to close off the conversation because we haven't heard from Matt yet. So Robert and then Matt.
Great. So thanks, Steve, for putting this together. I think that you know, you asked for some clarification on RMP Energy Storage's position and summary there, so I'm just going to provide that. First of all, the first bullet there, you know, we were looking at this, and we have been for a very long time. Energy storage is most like, in terms of what is operating on the system, it's most currently like a dispatchable generator. So paying STS is the closest option. One thing there is that incorporated in that option is that during charging, it would be interruptible by the ISO. I think that's critical. So as part of the best option, it would be STS treatment for tariff, but it would be interruptible during charging. And then the second option, which is what is it second most like, is a tie line. When we look at a tie line, yes, it's interruptible, but it is also paying a rate. So it's not that we're not paying any rates. It's that we're paying an opportunity rate, as I suggested through the modeling that I presented. And it would be a rate that is, if the interruptible component is on a shorter time period or shorter amount of notice than a transmission line, that rate should be measurably less because there is greater value in that shorter notice to interruption. And so those were the two options, and just wanted to clarify those.
Yeah, no, thanks for that.
Thanks, Robert. Let's go Matt, and then we're going to hop into break.
Hi there. My question is around the ISO's proposed, one of your proposed options where you mentioned having an interruptible rate for storage when charging and having it bid in the merit order. Would the ISO look at this as, you know, extending this to any bids, or is this specific to energy storage as a specific technology? I.e., would any load that submitted a bid into the merit order, would they be eligible for a interruptible rate?
And Matt, if you could just also state your organization.
Oh, Capital Power.
So if we're going to design a rate, we would do our best to make that rate as technology agnostic as possible. Again, without saying we don't have a design for this yet. We just see it as an option that we're exploring. So I can't give you specifics on it, but the idea would be that it would be a rate that those eligible to be applied for that rate could apply for. I don't know if that answers your question as well as you'd like, but that's about as far as we've got with this. So
I heard that works. I think I would, you know, suggest that, you know, if you're going down that path, you know, there's interrelationships with, you know, any sort of mitigation proposals to our earlier conversations.
Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, guys.
The time is 10:42. We're scheduled to have a half an hour break. We're going to make that a 20-minute break. So we're going to get back at 11:02 is when we're going to come back from break and resume the conversation. For Horst and Paula, feel free to throw your questions in the Q&A and we'll see where we get to and make through that. So thanks, everyone. We'll see you in 20. All right, 11:02. Hopefully everyone's had a chance to recharge, get a snack, refill coffees if you need it, and we're going to continue on to the conversation. So I'm going to invite Spencer maybe to respond to one of the questions right out of the break.
Sure. Thanks, Jordan. So we had a question just about the title of one of the slides, whether it was areas of agreement referred to stakeholders or to the ISO or both. And we just want to clarify that's areas where we think we all agree. Including the ISO, and we want your feedback on these to make sure we capture them, that you agree with that and that we capture them correctly. So hopefully that helps to clarify, and then we can get started with our next topic, our next theme rather, which is this theme. Now we're getting into themes that we're not exploring or that we're trying to put to bed here. So the first one has to do with continuing the status quo. And this is one that I know has been on a lot of our minds. So I'll spend a little bit of time trying to set the stage here and give us some points to talk about. And then we will take a few of the questions that we had earlier this morning on this. So the first slide, slide 46, is relates to transmission cost drivers. And there were a number of stakeholders who identified this particular report that we put on our website as part of the materials for the first stakeholder session on the Balkan Regional rate process that we're in, as being really important for them to get an understanding of the different drivers for transmission planning at the ISO. And you can take a look at that if you like. We can put a link in the chat or you can find it just in the materials on our website. But a number of you pointed to it, and so we thought we'd just capture some of the examples of drivers from that report. These aren't all the examples of the projects, but they just give you a sense of the different types of drivers in our transmission planning. So the main point here is that there's load, for sure, is a driver of transmission projects. It shows up in two of these different categories. So the local load supply and regional load and generation together. And there's a couple of projects that are examples of those types of projects. But there are a lot of other drivers as well. And that ranges from these kind of bulk power transfers to generation integration. So providing capability to integrate new types of generation into the system and in our open access framework. So we think this is a good place to start this conversation, just to give a, you know, remind everyone that we're dealing with a number of different factors that are contributing to transmission costs. So the next slide is 47. We did an update just on the units, on the dollars. So we're that's why it has that red updated font. But basically this graph is trying to show how the use of the system has evolved over time. So that's the green and blue line. The green line is our total coincident meter demand. So that's the sum of each monthly system peak each year since 2006. The blue is our billing capacity NCP, non-coincident peak, the sum of that each year since 2006. And the red line is, and this is on the right-hand axis, is basically the capital investments over that same time period that have been made. And, you know, you can criticize this. It's comparing, you know, kind of stocks and flows, which is not really an appropriate comparison. We're not trying to draw, you know, super strong conclusions about this, but I think it's raising this question around the alignment between the concepts of cost causation and the investment that we've made or the transmission projects that we've built. And it's really, you know, interesting place to start the conversation to say, well, look at, you know, the change in coincident meter demand. That's our system peak demand. And relative to our billing capacity or non-coincident peak demand, and again, relative to our changes in capital costs, right? We recognize that, you know, it's not a perfect comparison, but at the same time, you know, we're not seeing the kind of correlation that you might be expecting to see if our cost causation approach was truly reflecting this fundamental relationship between coincident meter demand and our investment in transmission projects. So the drivers have changed. We're seeing this relationship kind of changing. And, you know, maybe it's not the perfect comparison, but slide 48, the next one, is trying to drill into this in a little bit of a different, drill into this relationship in a little bit of a different way. And so we've plotted the charges for each of our billing determinants, so coincident peak billing capacity and energy charges, but we've used a common denominator, in this case, dollars per megawatt hour, since it's a unit of measure that we're familiar with. You know, you could use another measure, you could show a proportion, but the idea here is just establish the relationship between these three charges over time. And the conclusion, or the, you know, the one that stands out, which is probably no surprise, is our, you know, coincident peak charge has climbed significantly in comparison to billing capacity and energy charges, which have, you know, in the case of energy, has barely changed at all over this you know, multi decade and a half time period that we're looking at here. And again, this isn't, you know, this is really the driver behind why we're looking at these, why we're looking at this question today, is we've had a common cost allocation approach throughout this time period. We've applied it in this systematic way over this time period, and the outcome or the results have led to these very different changes in the charges that customers ultimately face. And so for that reason, we're you know, really looking at this question and unpacking, you know, why that is and whether it's appropriate to continue. So to sum up, the next slide, 49, is really trying to get at, you know, the key reasons for this case for change. So we've seen these changing transmission project drivers. So transmission projects are, you know, the result of a multitude of different drivers, not just peak demand. And yet we're recovering, you know, all of the costs of transmission above at 240 and above on our coincident peak charge, regardless of whether they're peak demand related. So that's point number one now. The second point really centers around customers have more options today. So, you know, the cost of alternatives has changed. Customers have more ways to meet their energy needs. And the way that we've allocated costs on coincident peak charges, you know, makes it feasible to change your use at peak times. And, you know, if that is in proportion to future transmission cost savings, that would strictly be by coincidence. That's not by design. And so the approach that we've taken has led us to this area, this time where billing determinants or coincident meter demand, as an example, are beginning to fall. And that, you know, is another factor that's increasing the amount of charges we're collecting from other customers on that same coincident peak demand charge. So that has to do with our third category. And what we're saying is this is not a sustainable path. And so the more that customers are responding to this price, the more costs are left for other customers, which increases that incentive. And that's kind of counterproductive in terms of a price signal that, you know, as customers use less of a good, the price should generally fall. And so because, you know, for all these different factors, because that's not the case, we don't think applying this for our, you know, long-term cost recovery is going to be sustainable. I think that's the quickest time that I can give it justice. And we do want to break here and or pause here, sorry, and open it up to get your perspectives.
Okay, let's start with Dale and then we'll go to Horst. Just as a reminder to also state your organization.
Hi, it's Dale Hildebrand representing the dual use customers. Let's just go back to slide 47. Two comments. One is that the fact that CMD has not, you know, increased substantially over the last 15 years says to me that the price signal in the tariff is working. The 12 CP price signal was intended for customers to try and avoid the peak, and that's exactly what they did. And the fact that network investment, you know, has skyrocketed, I think you need to look in the mirror. Right? It's the Alberta government and the ISO that asked for these transmission upgrades. And now that they're here, it's, I think, wildly inappropriate then to expect those customers who don't use those network additions, primarily the bulk system, to have to pay for it. Thank you.
Thanks, Dale. Let's go to Horst next and then Colette. I think you still need to come off mute, Horst.
Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Okay. Thanks. So this is Horst from Suncor. Could we go to slide 49, please? So I'm a bit surprised here because the ICE is making a case for change that kind of the current design has to change. But reading this, this is actually a case for change to go from an embedded cost to a marginal cost. It's not a case for change that like a 12 CP approach or something similar is inappropriate. Because if we look at the second bullet and then the second sub bullet, you're talking about a marginal incentive. You're talking about that the allocation of costs to reduce at peak time is not in proportion to future transmission cost savings. That is exactly the idea behind a marginal signal. Send them the signal so that the savings are appropriate for the cost that you allocated, so you actually get the efficient outcome. The other one is under bullet three, again, second sub-bullet is it's a case against embedded costs again, because the whole reason why costs are going up for others, because some customers are responding, is because we do this embedded approach where we simply divide the pie among everybody who's there. It has nothing to do with the actual impact a customer has on the system. So maybe as a challenge to the ISO, reread your own case for change. And then I think you'll come to the conclusion that this is not a case for change away from a method like 12CP or kind of any kind of coincident measures, which really make sense as an allocation method. It is really a case to change away from an embedded signal to a marginal signal, because the embedded signal is what causes you the grief.
Hey, thanks, Horst. Let's go Colette and then Akira.
Hi, everyone. It's Colette Shakurta representing the Alberta Direct Connect Consumers Association. And maybe you could just go back to slide 47. I just want to build on a couple of comments that Dale made, which I agree with. We keep talking about that we can't look back and that the CP signal isn't, it's just simply too expensive now. But the reason that we've got into the problem that we are in today is not because of the rate design. It's because of the network investment that happened from 2014 to 2019, which if you look at this chart, you could deduce that we built or invested this money not for anything to do with load or load growth in the province. It was simply a policy decision. And so for us to use economic principles that say, we can't look back, we have to look forward at what the next marginal piece is, that simply, to me, doesn't seem fair or hold water to the fact that, like, no load customer in Alberta was really responsible for this increase. It was a policy decision, it was cost overruns, it was all of these things that are, other people should be accountable for. And so I'm having a very difficult time if we say, okay, well, that's too bad. Let's forget about that and just look forward at a marginal cost, but not looking back at, how customers did behave, how they did respond to price signals, and just say that doesn't matter going forward, I think is inappropriate. And, if we want to build a rate that's based on an evidentiary record and cost causation, to me is a principle of that. Then I think looking at just marginal costs and forgetting about what happened with this network investment is flawed. So sorry, just more of a comment than a question.
No, we appreciate it, Colette. Thank you. Akira, let's get you unmuted.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Awesome. This is Akira Yamamoto from TransAlta. Just a couple of points. I think, Spencer, you did preface some of the conclusions that are being drawn, but I see the mistake being made. So as Horst had said previously, whatever billing determinant you provide the signal on would also see the response. So for instance, when you look at this slide that you've got up on slide 47, if you actually had it on DTS contract rates and the signal being very strong there, then I would anticipate that would actually start flatlining as well. And the less of the signal is on the coincident meter demand charge, then you would see that still showing an upward increasing trend. So I think that it's a little bit difficult to kind of draw too many conclusions from this, as you kind of mentioned. But I think the other thing too, and it causes some concern, on slide 49, and I think these are the things that the industrial customers are speaking to, is It's a little bit perplexing on the second one where you say billing determinants began or beginning to fall, because that's exactly what your rate model was actually designed to incentivize. And so it does feel like it's a game that when you play, or sorry, when you respond in the way that the ISO's designed the rate design, and it's too strong beyond what you would have anticipated, that ultimately you'll just change the rules of the game so that those decisions become bad decisions later on. And I think that's a significant frustration, because how do we prevent this from happening in the future? And I think that's really the question here, is when we modernize this tariff design, we don't want to find ourselves 5 years down the road with a different design that creates exactly the same types of issues, just in a different way. And so I think that's kind of the difficult exercise that we're kind of being tasked with, is a change for change's sake is obviously dangerous, but we need to make sure that we aren't replicating the types of concerns with your new tariff design, just in a different way. Because I think it's, people will start losing confidence in the system itself. And ultimately that drives to the decisions that you don't really want to see, which is entire erosion of the billing determinants, because those customers are gone. So just words of caution, and obviously be tread carefully on some of the conclusions that you're making on these. So thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Akira. Let's go to Paula.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Hi. And I think I've said this a few times, and I've heard it on this call, and I've heard it on multiple calls, but I just want to raise my hand to say, are there other creative ways of dealing with this other than those presented? And what I'm hinting heavily at is that there was transmission built in the past. TFCMC was one of the cost monitoring committees for it. The ISO and NEED and entities that actually were involved in the tariff submissions, et cetera. But the regulatory oversight on whether or not this was needed, probably it was there, but now looking back, it's like, well, why do we need this? Have we overbuilt the system? Is it built for more than what we need? And the question is, can we deal with this creatively outside of the tariff structure? Because as you're hearing today, it was not caused by demand for this. So just to raise my hand to say, is there a way to look at this outside of the existing regulatory structure? It would require a political solution, not necessarily a regulatory solution. But I think to load the load with all of these costs for historical transmission that was possibly overbuilt is just really going to put heavy impacts on these businesses that during COVID and during oil and gas prices that are low is going to cause a strain on the economics for Alberta. And so the question is there some out of the box thinking that could be done that is not within the tariff?
Thank you for the comment, Paula. We appreciate that. Any other observations, comments, questions? Okay. I think I want to hand it over to Spencer just to kind of, is there any closing comments that you want to make there before, as we turn the page, I should say?
Sure. Yeah, no, thanks, Jordan. I think, you know, the question about how do we find a solution is a good one, and whether we're operating within our mandate and within our scope for this project. And that's not to say that creative ideas don't exist, but you know, what we're trying to do through this process is gather this information that we use in formulating our preferred option to move forward. So I think that's important just to keep in mind that, you know, we do recognize your comment, Paula. On the other comments as well, I think like we're right there with you. You know, the outcome of our current rate design has led to the trends that we're seeing today, and that, you know, like changes to coincident meter demand is a byproduct of the way that we've allocated cost to it. There's no question about that. you know, unwinding those effects is not easy. And we are treading with as much caution as we can muster to make sure that we're not, you know, creating a new version of this problem. And I think just on Horst's point there about, you know, this is a case for change towards marginal. I think it is what it is. We've tried to describe this in a way about how customers are responding. And certainly that is a, you know, the lens we're looking at that question through is an economic one. How do customers respond to incentives? And I would just, you know, to accept your challenge a little bit, if you look at, you know, the changes in the drivers for transmission projects, and you frame the information in a way that looks at the drivers, and you're drawing those cost causation arguments to create those links with the drivers, I think that's an embedded methodology that would potentially, you know, change the approach that has led us to where we are today. But I think, you know, that's just a which side of the coin you emphasize more than anything. So I think that's, you know, the idea that the price signal is working and the customers have responded, like, yeah, we know, and we're recognizing that in how we're moving forward. And we'll get into that later on today. Coming up very shortly, actually, is like, okay, if we change, now what? And how do we deal with the impacts? Because, you know, we do see the potential for you know, new types of response and what, where is their value? So hopefully that's helpful. And thank you for those comments. It's really good. We'll, you know, we're keeping these issues top of mind as we progress through this. So is there anything, Nicole, you want to add to that? And if not, we can jump into our next theme. Okay. So the last piece that I'll touch on today is this idea of adding more complexity to our rate design. And so this is really related to this concept of regional peaks. And so we've been, you know, working these concepts and trying to understand where there's value and how we would implement these complex. So if we go to our next slide, where are we at now? Slide 52. So this is, you know, kind of the idea of moving from a coincident system peak to a coincident regional peak that we presented as our bookend B. And we want to identify these concerns where we have heard from our stakeholders on different aspects of this. And there are a number of different pieces that we think are important for this consideration. So the first one is really around just plain and simple correlation between system and region peak demands. And that occurs throughout the province, except for really in the Northwest. And there's, you know, reasons for that I'm sure you're aware of, but for the most part, there's really high correlation between system and region peak demand. Again, correlation is kind of a tricky one because people are responding to system peak, and there is, you know, moving to a region peak may change how people are responding in those regions. But even with that considered, there's very little significant difference outside of the Northwest. The other important concept as it relates to this regional peak question has to do with, you know, the fundamental nature of transmission constraints, which are a product of supply and demand. And what we presented in our bookend B was based on demand alone. And I think Suncor pointed out that in their proposal, which was really a more accurate implementation of a regional coincident peak design, you need to look at transmission as the, you know, a equal part of this question. So for example, if we look at the Northwest, if the generation in the Northwest is, you know, not online, then peak load behavior in the Northwest is likely a factor in contributing to a transmission constraint. On the other hand, when generation is dispatched, peak load behavior is much less likely to contribute to a transmission system constraint. And so, you know, this is really just meant to try to illustrate the connection between, you know, regional constraints that are a product of both supply and demand alone. If we were to implement this type of model, I think the level of additional information that we would need to use for billing and for metering is probably more than six times what we do today. And the risk on that is really, you know, around when there's questions we have today about, you know, do we have the right system peak demand hour? How is that calculated? You know, there's six times as many opportunities for that type of you know, questioning that we're facing, and that would take time and energy for both sides of that question to resolve. And, you know, recognizing that we have a legislative framework that requires a postage stamp pricing so that rates do not vary by virtue of your location in the province is, you know, kind of the final piece of this puzzle that, you know, when we presented this, we coined it as arguably postage stamp or something along those lines. But, you know, this is just another aspect that if we're trying to push against this legislative framework, you know, where is their value? How does it improve on our system? You know, our current use of system peak as a billing determinant. And so for all these reasons, we're basically not pursuing this concept further. And you should expect not to see it, or you shouldn't expect to see it in our preferred rate design that we put forward. So hopefully that closes off some questions to narrow our scope a little bit. And I think that's it on this, and we can take some questions if there are any.
So one question that I'm seeing, Spencer, and we'll see what hands rise up to, but Richard Penn's asked, with IPCA's asked a couple of times, about Ramsey pricing. So I'm wondering if you can speak to that.
Okay, Ramsey pricing. I think this relates to our previous topic. And Ramsey pricing, to dust off my economics training, has to do with setting or recovering costs from customers in a way that reflects their own demand elasticity, which basically means that, you know, customers that have a flexibility to respond are not allocated as much cost as customers that do not have as much ability to respond. It has a certain economic efficiency benefit or attribute, let's say, that it can be helpful in terms of, you know, reducing the distortions. But it's, you know, it definitely plays against the question of fairness and whether that's a fair approach. So I think in some of our stakeholder proposals, we have heard that our current rate structure does allow has some Ramsey pricing attributes. But I think, is there a more specific question, Richard, that we want to unpack here, or is it maybe I'll let that, if there's more to talk about, let us know. But without seeing your specific question.
Yeah. He's got to hand up now. Let's get Richard muted and we can have a bit of a back and forth dialogue.
Well, Spencer, the issue is there's just too much money spent, right? And you're just moving money around from one pot to another. And I don't really, as you move it from, let's say, 12 CP to 120 CP or whatever you do, people who can respond still will respond, right? They'll just say, you know what, it's 120 CP. I'll just I've got a cheaper solution, and I'll just do whatever to leave the grid or reduce my CP, because I'll do it over 120 hours instead of 12 hours, right? So you're not, people who can respond will still respond, right? No matter what you do, they're still going to respond because the price, the costs are too high. And so what you need to do is you need to look at a system where you don't, I guess in a way, you don't want some people to respond because in responding, you're pushing costs onto others. What you want to do to is come to some sort of allocation where, you know, everybody's not happy, but everybody's not leaving. Not a lot of people aren't leaving at the same time. And that's the whole idea of the Ramsey pricing allocation, is to decide on what's the level at which people who can respond will say it's just not economic to respond anymore. And other costs go on the folks who can't respond, right? Because whatever, all the schemes you're proposing right now, all still lead to response, right? You'll have to agree to that, right? They're all going to still lead to response.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you there, Richard. And I think it's an important point. And my line of questioning, I suppose, on this would be, is there a difference in terms of the response between a 1 hour per month versus every hour per month versus all energy? Is that an important aspect that, you know, it's a different ability to respond to those different things. But I don't disagree that people will respond. And I think it's understanding how that really matters.
Let's get Christine unmuted. Christine?
Hi, Christine, Power Advisory, representing the DCG Consortium. This is really just a clarification question. I'm trying to understand what's left in the path forward. So if we're no longer considering regional peak, and the big question that's left on the table is, are we looking at embedded or marginal costs? Is the ISO back to a world where we're probably keeping 12 CP or maybe moving to this 120 seasonal CP, but other than those two kind of options, for the most part, we're really just trying to nail down if we want an embedded approach that leaves the rates more or less at their current size, or a marginal approach, which I'm expecting is likely to shrink some of those demand charges and move some money into a fixed charge. And that's the only questions left on the table, or is there still more scope to discuss that I'm missing here?
Yeah, that's a fair question. I think you've summarized it well. We do have, towards the end of this presentation, some areas where we do have outstanding questions that are related to those. And to be completely frank with you, I think we presented a range, a spectrum defined by these two bookends. And as we've gone through this process and have heard from our stakeholders, where we are narrowing down, it doesn't mean that those and, you know, bookends are still the, you know, we're not saying it's going to be one or the other. It's really just trying to concentrate on what are the fundamental issues here that we do need to resolve. I think you hit on the main ones, which are our cost allocation, that embedded versus marginal question, and then, you know, where those are allocated in terms of the rate design, whether that has you know, whether that resembles the same billing determinants we have today, or whether that's, you know, something like what we've heard from the stakeholder proposals. We are narrowing the scope of our focus onto those types of questions. We definitely want your feedback if you think there's something missing that we need to keep considering at this point. I hope that helps answer your question.
Yeah, that's helpful. And I'll just follow up with one more. Does the ISO at this point have any sense of what the size of the rates would end up as if we move to a marginal approach? Understanding kind of where we are in the consultation process, it's looking to me like if the ISO lands on preferring a marginal approach in the very next session, that's what you'll come out with as your preferred, and then we'll get bill impacts for that. But then we're almost past the point of being able to influence change. So it would be helpful if we could get an understanding of what these two options look like before we're kind of past the point of being able to influence your direction.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. We don't have rates that we can share at this point. And I think that that's, you know, that's part of this process is we're coming up with what our recommendation is. We're looking for feedback at this stage. We're looking for feedback at that stage. And that's just the nature of where we're at in this process.
Okay, thank you.
Let's go, Robert.
Hi, guys. This is Robert Stewart, RMP Energy Storage. I just want to make a comment again. I think that there's a lot of really good comments and questions coming in, and outside of a buyout of the transmission assets by some entity outside of the market, these costs are going to be, and that's outside of the ISO's kind of mandate. The ISO has to present a path that deals with these costs as they are. And I think that when you look at the current CP12 active participants, the dollar amount that we're looking at is a lot of money for those participants, but it is not a lot of money for the bulk, the rest of the system. And I think that looking at the classes of customers currently, all of them are paying on the same methodology because we're looking at them all wanting the same product, but we have different classes of customers, that want different products. So offering a non-firm rate to customers who are able to avoid CP12 would enable the system to avoid some of these additional costs and have them as active participants within the market, and would also enable us to avoid the issue of stranding some of those investments that have been made by these participants. So, and I think it also ties into how energy storage can be incorporated as a non-firm customer. Perhaps these are different levels based upon how quickly someone responds to a signal. But I think that really we can break everyone into a firm and a non-firm customer and allocate those costs that way. So I want to know, is that something that we can look at in more detail?
Yeah, I think that is something that we will look at in more detail. We categorize that in terms of our path to minimal disruption. So we will talk about that a little bit later today, and definitely, welcome your thoughts and perspective on that. And I think it's a very fair comment.
All right, let's go, Ed, and then we're going to move on to the next topics.
Thanks. Spencer, just a question for you. You've talked, I think, a lot in this presentation about the questions that remain outstanding. And then you've said you're going to come back at the end of February with a solution, a recommended solution. So could you talk about your process? So what is the ISO going to do between today and February 25th to come up with that solution?
I think that's a good question. I think one of the things we've really benefited from throughout this process is your feedback and your input. And so we're looking for that today because it does help us in understanding your perspective on these questions. I think, what we're going to do between now and February is basically try to narrow down the list of issues and the areas that we think there's disagreement so that we can come back with our preference at that time. We know that bill impact is a really important component of that. So we're looking at how these, how these options would have a bill impact and what our steps are to mitigate that. And that's something we're going to be talking about next, the process around that. And we're seeking, the the information that you think would be helpful in us coming up with this decision. So I'm not sure if there's anything more that I can get Nicole to add on that. Hopefully that's helpful.
Maybe I would add, I think there's the process is a bit of a mix of science and art. We've laid out the objectives of what we're trying to achieve that we shared and discussed on the 24th, put out our bookends and you've seen the other proposals, which really kind of led into, well, what are all the kind of tools or options, but the combinations of them does get, can get kind of large, but fundamentally it's kind of just trading off. Are you determining the buckets of money and what billing determinants are you putting them towards? I think, and we'll be working through that as we look at the objectives and historical guidance and design decisions and coming back with our proposal.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thanks, Ed. We're going to move on then to mitigation and minimal disruption. And I'll apologize if you can hear my coworkers in the background. It's lunchtime. We got to feed the inmates. So.
Hello, everybody. I have to get my voice working. So we're on slide 55 and next slide there, Claudia. What do we mean by minimal disruption? And the next few slides are going to be providing details or a view to help stakeholders understand, you know, what the next few months will look like as we work towards steps towards determining a path to minimal disruption. We're not here to, you know, present the mitigation options or anything like that, but just kind of make sure that there's a good understanding of what the next few months will look like, what you can expect to see, what kind of understanding we hope to provide to you. And we know this path is critical. We understand this difficult balance that we need to achieve between looking for appropriate cost recovery mechanisms and ensuring or removing the potential that an increase in cost allocation to some customers could result in them leaving the grid. I mean, the ISO as well as stakeholders in our last session provided, you know, a pretty strong indication this is not an outcome that we want. This isn't good for Alberta, and it's not good for the rest of people paying for the transmission system. The other thing we just want to point out to you is that when we're talking about a path to change, we're not only talking about a path, but like as a path through time, like can changes be phased in to allow customers time to respond to new tariff signals so they get a recognition or value from their response and other ratepayers also get that value as well in order to manage costs. So that's just a second dimension to what we're talking about when we talk about path to minimal disruption. So in slide 56, we were talking about mitigation options. This should be a good, fairly fulsome table of the options that we could be looking at. So we try to categorize them into rate design options or bill adjustment options. So under rate design, we're looking for design mechanisms that in of themselves allow for bill impact mitigation. So as I mentioned before, the phase-in tariff, that could be a design element where you could look at the bulk cost recovery going from a larger part of 12CP to a lower amount over a certain number of years, and that's an example. We can also look at adjustment periods where this allows customers to reflect or look at their grid requirements, give them time to adjust their contract amounts or reset ratchets in response to a new tariff design. And there could be some bill impact mitigation occur in those types of responses. And as there's a number of conversations today about rate classes. And, you know, this is ensuring that if there's value in customers responding in a certain manner, or there's a group of customers that use the grid in a very unique way, where value is provided to other ratepayers, we would want that to be handled through rate design. That's where we get the most value for all users of the grid. So those kind of examples are an interruptible or a standby rate. We could be looking at load attraction retention rates. for the category of bill adjustments. So these are more discrete or targeted options in our mitigation bucket. We can look at, you know, a certain percentage increase over a certain amount of time, limited to a certain amount of increase per year. This would be a matter of bill credits created or funded through other rates to allow that this bill impact minimization occurs to customers that would be impacted by a tariff design change. And that, so that'd be transitionary. And then we could also look to permanent bill reductions. And that is you know, just a bill increase of no more than X percent funded through bill credits. So additionally, at our November session, a number of stakeholders presented their proposals, and they also presented their thoughts on bill mitigation. And we've listed out here, and all of these options still exist in the table we've put above here. We haven't ruled anything out, just to give you a full perspective of all the options available to us at this time. So on slide 57, I want to talk about the likely path to minimal disruption. So how does ISO plan to meet our objective of a path to minimal disruption? This will be a major part of our work over the next few months. You know, as everything in the design world, trade-offs are involved, and we want to find the most value to be achieved in combination between rate design and the mitigation, the billing mitigation, either through, like I said, the design mechanisms or the targeted adjustments or a combination of both. You know, we see that it's likely that the most value can be achieved through a rate design category or style of bill mitigation. So we are definitely pursuing that and looking at that. It is important to acknowledge that mitigation may not be symmetric for all customers. And this really is a factor of the uniqueness of all sites in Alberta, never mind the impacted sites, the sites that could be looking in any tariff design that reduces the amount of 12CP, the impact on their bill. You know, the reason why it's very discrete or targeted and not symmetrical is every site uses power in a very different way and has different options to their sites to respond to any tariff design price signal. And we want to recognize that. So the impact of all of this is that we need to develop a transition path that minimizes rate increases. We could be looking at whether there's a rate impact over the period of time or a number of years. And, you know, it's important to consider that it's not helpful to our goal of path to minimal disruption that if you phase in a change over 5 years and at the end of the 5 years or at some point, this customer is still at the same spot. So we need to recognize that concern. You know, the ISO is going to analyze rate impacts for all customers. For every general tariff application in the past, the ISO provides a bill impact analysis for all rate DTS sites. And that's to ensure there's like complete transparency, but transparency and visibility of the impact on rate design changes onto a variety of types of customers. We'll be spending a lot of time of figuring out how to share that bill impact analysis to stakeholders over this leading up to February. I know that the bill impact tool that we put out there, we're going to look for some additional transparency or effectiveness that we can ensure that our stakeholders are fully informed without providing site-by-site information, which would be problematic. And so when we assess rate impacts, we're talking about a combination of two things, and I'm going to talk about that in a little bit. But the ISO is going to continue to consider additional rate classes as I mentioned, to reflect that different users use the grid differently, and then use that analysis to evaluate how the additional rate classes can impact or reduce bills as part of our path to minimal disruption. So there's a ton of work happening there. and we'll continue to be working on as we get ready for February and after February. So, and I mean, it is key that we're, of course, we're keeping these options open because we're still narrowing on our rate design approach, and the rate design approach will impact which options are available to us. So that part is also, of course, on our view here. And so at this stage, no mitigation option has been removed at this stage. So slide 58, our engagement plan. There's a lot of detail here, and I hope that this helps stakeholders understand what might be happening over the next few months and give them a little bit of comfort of what they can expect to see and when they can expect to see some analysis. And so first of all, starting at the top, session four, we're here today. I'm presenting the mitigation schedule, and we're going to be looking for comments back and hearing your written feedback on this plan and see if there's anything we've missed or you would like us to talk about a little bit more. But it all does come down to the fact that we're going to be extremely busy from now until session five working on this. And what I mean working on, it will be that bill impact summary. I don't know exactly what that will look like. We want to build on the bill impact analysis exhibits that we typically include in our GTA applications. And that kind of leads to, in order to do an accurate bill impact analysis for all sites, you need to know site-by-site information. And so even in an anonymous or coded manner, that specific detail can't be provided externally. So there's going to be work that the ISO will need to do inside the ISO and be able to ensure that what we provide externally provides value and is a good summary of the impacts of any rate design change or mitigation options. You know, this is all about providing the clarity and the transparency as much as we can. And additionally, we're looking at providing the hourly bill impact tool, an updated one, and this can be building off of what we presented on our October 14th session. And this tool allows customers to import their hourly load and see what the impact of a certain rate design option or options and mitigation options would be on their site alone. And so some of the feedback we got from October 15th was that could we look at more years, from 2 to 5 years, and we'll continue to look at that. Just want to make sure we can do it in a way that doesn't create a file that is completely unwieldy, that is still useful for stakeholders. So we're looking into that. Another comment we got is how can we model future response to the price signal? And I haven't got to it yet, but do believe that's possible to allow customer to now say, okay, here's what my bill would be under this tariff design with this mitigation. Let me now respond to it and adjust my billing determinants and see what my rate would be. That's not a difficult thing to add, and it's a little added feature we could look at adding. And then the other item that we talk about we're going to be bringing forward in the session five is beginning to discuss implementation considerations. And it's really to reflect that we got this ahead of us. We want to provide as much transparency or visibility of where we're at. And it really does depend on how the next month or two will go. Some tough analysis is required and tough impact analysis. And so, you know, based on that, we'll see how much we can bring to session five on implementation considerations. So following session five, we're looking at adding another technical session, similar to the October 14th, where stakeholders can really, you know, test the bill impact tool or any other tool, be able to ask us questions, help us understand how they would be using the tool, and see how it's working for them. And additionally, we've put into our plan potential one-on-one meetings, and this is where customers that might be uncomfortable sharing their own site hourly data in a public forum could just run through their data with the ISO and talk to us about how the tool provides them information and any direct technical questions they may have. You know, for this exercise, we want to balance the need for transparency We understand that there's conversations that need to be happening in our stakeholder engagement. So that's why we're limiting those one-on-one conversations to be just discussions about the bill impact tool. And then further, then we'll be having comments where we will be looking for feedback from stakeholders on all that information provided, as well as how the design options and mitigations impact their particular site, and provide feedback back to the ISO on that. So on slide 59, just to sort of summarize everything I've run through here fairly quickly. This is our plan to meet our objective of a path to minimal disruption. And we're committed to providing stakeholders as much information as we can. And that information includes data tools, data analysis tools. And that's another reason why we've added the technical session and the 101s. We want to make sure that you're informed and that we can provide as much as we can to help you understand impact, and not only on your site, but also province-wide to all load customers. And we feel that the combination of this sort of a plan can ensure the broadest of understanding of the impacts. And, you know, as we think there's a large amount of value to developing a shared understanding ahead of the regulatory proceeding. And so that's why we are striving to provide as many options, or gather the data, the analysis, the impact and feedback to be included in our application. And so that we feel it would be a lot more efficient to understand these concepts, to understand impact as much as possible before the regulatory proceeding occurs, and seeking some regulatory efficiency there and using these steps to achieve that. So I'm on slide 60, so any questions?
Let's start with Dale, and then I want to go to Akira's question in the chat.
Hi, LaRonda. Can I take you back to slide 55, please? Thank you. So I think this is where we have a fundamental disagreement with the ISO, and I just want to bring it up and give you a chance to respond. So the first one here, continuation of current tariff incentives increases the risk of cost shifting between customers who can respond to those incentives and those who cannot. So we don't see that as a risk. We see that as the goal of the tariff. That's what the price signal in the tariff is supposed to do, is drive customer behavior. And if some customers can respond and some can't, I think that's irrelevant. Like, this is not a communist tariff, right? The Bombray principles are send the price signals and those who can respond will respond for the benefit of everybody.
Well, I guess you started off at the beginning, maybe that is a fundamental disagreement, that the incentives going to those that can shift costs are larger than the value being achieved. You have to go right back to our whole, our tariff design and looking for the case for change. That's true, but our data shows that if this continuing cost transfer between customers that can respond and those who can't will have an impact that is not a good outcome for load payers or for Alberta.
Okay. I saw a question from Akira in the chat. Just give me one second. I'm going to pull it up again. Can you hear me, LaRonda?
I can see Akira's question. Why does the ISO prefer rate design mitigations over bill adjustments?
Yes.
Okay. There's a couple things. the part where a customer, a certain customer that uses the grid very differently than another group of customers and the way they use it, if they're more responsive, essentially they use, if their behavior, in their load behavior creates value for other ratepayers, then I capturing that value and transferring it using a rate class, I believe is a better outcome. The issues for the bill adjustments are, there's always challenges in implementation. You know, if we, just for example, this is just for example, it's not a primary concern, but if there's a customer receiving a bill impact sort of credit, and maybe in 7 years, something changes in their market and they want to increase their load. Now, how do we deal with that? And we want to constantly be sending the appropriate signals so that we don't get these sort of perverse outcomes where a customer is forced to understand the impact of that bill adjustment versus what they could achieve through, you know, increasing their load at the site.
Thanks, Laronda. I saw Raj Retnanandan had his hand up before, but he's gone away. Raj R, are you wanting to get involved in this? Yeah, let's get Raj R unmuted.
On the same issue, Laronda, which you responded to Akira, I think that is an issue of balance. I think, leaning more towards the rate design side for mitigation and less towards the bill impact side, bill credit side, I think what happens is you're going to be delaying the price signals that need to be provided going forward. So you want to do that, but at the same time, you want to reduce, mitigate the risk on the customer. Mitigate the cost of the increase. So that's sort of the balance I think one needs to think about, you know, rather than simply saying that the preference is to give effect to mitigation through tariff design as opposed to bill impact.
That's right. And I think we want to acknowledge that it is a difficult challenge, and maybe it's a combination of rate design and bill adjustments to achieve that correct balance. So that's a good point.
Okay, sorry, can I ask a clarifying question? Or just to make sure that I understand what you were getting at there, Raj, kind of there's the two sides of the coin, maybe of we want to make changes to the rate design that will send future efficient signals, but the purpose of mitigation is mitigating the impact to maybe customers that have made decisions under the past rate design, and you're saying the rate mitigation options will kind of delay the implementation of the rate changes to all customers, and there's a downside to that versus the rate, what the words we are using, the bill adjustments just target the impacted parties while the rate design changes can flow through to everyone else. Is that fair?
Yeah, in a sense, but I think, the bill credits would probably be more focused, but I'm not too concerned about the bill credits as much as providing the right price signals to on a go-forward basis as soon as possible. As soon as you restructure the rates, you are then beginning to provide the right price signals to not only, the current customers, but also future customers who are looking at the economy and saying, what are my rates going to be? And the nature of industry in this province is changing quite significantly. So these people are all looking for the right price signals. So I think that's where the balance lies.
Thanks.
Thanks, Raj. We're going to go Colette's. And then we'll do, I saw Matt's question, in the Q&A that I think is good. And then we'll end off with Christine and move on to the next topic.
Okay. It's, Colette Chikurta with the ADC. I just want to, make a follow-up comment to Raj's there. I think doing a bill credit
is the absolutely wrong way to go moving forward for several reasons. One, it's like, how do you determine how much bill credit one customer should get over another customer? Who decides that? The red tape that you're introducing with that kind of process, I think is just untenable for all industrial customers or any customers that would be subject to this. It also creates some additional issues that are raised in our comments back to the ISO, which is having a specific rate credit to a specific industry or customer could jeopardize some of their free trade agreement. So I think if there's going to be any mitigation going forward, it needs to be in terms of the rate design and not a rate credit adjustment. I think the path we need to get on quickly here is developing a standby interruptible tariff that works for, you know, the customers that have flexibility and add value to the system. So that's just my comment on that. Thanks.
Thanks, Colette. Thanks for those comments. And that's why we have in our presentation that the rate design options are preferable to us. I agree.
Okay. Matt's question, Matt with Capital Power within the chat on process and engagement. How can we fairly review the preferred rate design at session 5 without understanding the mitigation path in session 6? Can you comment quickly on that, Laurent, Dispenser, Nicole?
Well, we want to provide you the tools and the data so that you can give us the feedback as we move towards the application. We are committed with this plan to provide as much timely information as possible around the February session. I mean, I haven't learned this year, I mean, the one thing I have is everything I thought is known is unknown. We're working really hard to provide the certainty for you. I can't guarantee it because this is a tough challenge. And I don't know if Nicole and Spencer want to add to that. We're working really hard to get you the data and analysis so that you can comment in time appropriately for our application so we get a regulatory efficient proceeding.
Maybe I'd just add that we do plan to have a mitigation path as part of the proposal that we share at session 5. And what was highlighted through the stages was more, we want to make sure that we're sharing information and having conversations with impacted parties as necessary for them to get clarity on the mitigation path and the impacts to them.
Okay, let's go Christine, and then we'll move on to our final topic.
Hi, Christine Runge with Power Advisory. I just wanted to respond to the comment that Raj made. I agree that the goal here needs to be we figure out what the end state of these rates are so that we are sending proper incentives to customers who may be considered future customers that are looking to connect to the grid. But I disagree that we can't achieve that with a transitional mechanism. The way I think about a transitional mechanism is if, for example, we were looking to transition to final rates over 5 years, the ISO could right now put out, this is our understanding of rates in year 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And that way you're sending a strong signal to investors because they understand in year 5, these are the rates and that's the end state that I'm now expecting to live with for 10 or 20 years. Customers aren't making investment decisions off of rates today. They're making investment decisions after their understanding of future expectations. So I think all of the concerns that Roz raised can be fully addressed through a transitional mechanism.
Thanks for that, Christine.
Okay. I'm going to sneak in one more question because we haven't heard from Peter yet. So let's get Peter unmuted and then we'll move on to the next topic.
Thank you. It is Peter Chen calling from Enbridge. I just want to comment on the tool, the calculation tool that you have provided. Maybe just a suggestion to add details such as, input boxes, allow the customer to put in their own capacity, like the contract capacity. So it would be a more accurate to determine the billing capacity. So to fit into your the different kind of calculation. So that's one comment. And I also found there's some mistake in the tool. So I'm sure like some of us who use the tool experienced that. So just those are my two comments.
Okay, I wrote down add contract. I do know that that is a bit of a weakness on it. And if you could forward the errors, that would be great. Otherwise, I don't know. I mean, I've used it a lot, so I'm curious. Thanks.
Sounds good. Thanks, Peter. Okay, let's move forward into our final topic.
Okay, thanks, Jordan. I think it's been a great discussion today, and we wanted to close out with our understanding of where we're at in terms of, you know, overall the areas we agree and disagree, and like we did in the energy storage section, these areas of agreement, I think, are areas where, you know, it's all of us together on these topics. And the areas of disagreement are really where we're going to have to focus our efforts in answering some questions. So if we go to the next slide, which is 62, we've tried to capture these areas where we agree kind of within our overall rate design objectives, because we think that helps to funnel into kind of the specifics of these different aspects where we're finding areas of agreement and disagreement. We've only listed the three here. The other two, I don't think we really need to get into this areas of agreement. So that's why these three are here. On the first one, it's efficient price signals. We've heard loud and clear today throughout the conversation, as well as in the previous sessions and the feedback we received, that price signals matter and that tariff charges provide incentives for customers to change behavior. So I think that's something that we can all agree on that concept at the highest level. In terms of cost responsibility, we're looking to confirm if this is true, but I think we're recognizing that it's more than just load behavior that's driving transmission projects and driving transmission costs, and that we are dealing with an evolving system. And so the way that, you know, we use the system today, it may differ from how the system was originally planned. And the area of minimal disruption, you know, we've been talking about this a lot today, and it has come up, you know, in previous conversations as well, that transmission costs have increased. And so, you know, I hear the concerns, and we're here today, and that's not really within our scope, but it does matter, because it means that what we do here in terms of changes to those, to the way we're collecting those costs, are more important now than ever. So we want to spend that time, get this focus on this now, to make sure that we're doing it as best we can. On the minimal disruption, the last one there is we want to recognize that it's super important for us to minimize disruption, and that means mitigating any rate shock. So we don't think it's in anyone's interest to reduce the number of ratepayers, and that's driving us on this minimal disruption objective. So that about sums up, I think, at this higher kind of principled level, the areas where we agree. And turning to our next slide, 63, we've captured these in the same kind of bucketing areas where we disagree. And it's not meant to be the ISO and stakeholders disagreeing. I think it's a common across, you know, different views that there are disagreements on these fundamental questions. So we're recognizing that. And the first one has to do with efficient price signals. And so, you know, the question there is, are status quo price signals efficient? And, you know, the argument is that price signals in the tariff have reduced the cost of energy for other load. On the other side, you know, we're asking the question as, are price signals forward-looking? And do price signals need to be efficient in the sense that they reflect how changes in customer behavior change future transmission costs? those, I think, are two different aspects or different ways of looking at the sufficient price signals question. In terms of cost responsibility, we have heard throughout this process the use of this term cost responsibility. So I think it's important to recognize that, you know, is the primary objective here cost causation or cost responsibility? And kind of clarify what is meant by those. And, you know, secondly, within this category, you know, the question around does the initial rate design or maybe status quo is probably a better term, rate design, is it still achieving our goal of cost causation if transmission costs have risen and load behavior hasn't influenced those costs? We know that load has responded. And that, you know, I think those are pretty fundamental questions. If there's different perspectives that have weighed in on this, and that's important to kind of unpack what the fundamental areas of disagreement are here. On the last piece, the minimal disruption piece, you know, we've talked a little bit about this earlier today, the idea that now is not the time for change, or on the flip side, you know, it's let's get going, it's too late, or you know, let's stop the bleeding, I think is the term we heard last session. We know that there's, you know, fundamental uncertainties around our world today, in our Alberta's economic climate, the policy that we're operating within. And we recognize that the changes that we're talking about here likely have pretty significant impacts, and they're not symmetric. So that's a fundamental kind of area of disagreement within this category. The last one, I think, is really around, does rate mitigation need to be permanent or can it be temporary? Can we phase that in? I think that, you know, we have had a little bit of conversation about that today. So all of these are in our comment matrix, and we are looking for some responses to that. I know we're running up against our allotted time, so maybe Jordan, if anyone has a question, if there's hands up, we can take a few of those quickly. But
yeah, we absolutely will. So we'll start with Victoria, and then we'll go to Colette.
Can you hear me okay, Jordan?
You bet we can.
Great. Just a couple of comments on where we agree. I think we can all agree that load growth will help solve our wires cost problem. I think we can all agree that economic growth is good for the province. I think we can all agree that we want to be an attractive location for investment, and that we all want a rate design that works for Alberta. And we've sort of been very narrowly focused, but I think those are bigger picture items that we really should keep track of here. Because at the end of the day, we're going to need something that works for the long term. And we're going to need to realize that the bigger picture isn't just pushing money around between different customers who react to power and use power differently. We need to come up with a system that makes us a place that's going to succeed, because the odds are not stacked in our favor right now. So going forward, when you frame this argument, I would probably try to look at it more through that lens. Just a comment. Thanks.
Thanks, Victoria. Let's go to Colette.
Hi, it's Colette again from the ADC. I agree with what Victoria just said, so I thought those were good comments on where we agree. On the where we disagree comment, I just wanted to kind of raise one item that, you know, I appreciate the ISO think about, and you don't have to answer it now, but Ali Al-Jabir from Brubaker had put this in the Q&A, but I wanted to just highlight it. And then the question is, you know, on where we disagree, you talk about, does the initial rate design still achieve goal since transmission costs have risen and low behavior has not influenced those costs? Well, the question is, has the ISO analyzed the amount of additional incremental transmission investment that would have occurred in Alberta had the customer response to the 12 CP price signal not been in place? In such an alternative scenario, run would help to identify transmission investment that was avoided as a result of the 12 CP rate design. So I think that's an important piece of analysis that I don't see has been undertaken anywhere. If, you know, if we look back
over the course of the rate design, and had we not had the signal in place, what would have been the outcome for the transmission system? I don't think we can pretend that the response did not have any influence on transmission costs. So just a point on where we disagree, and appreciate, you know, the ISO kind of thinking about that from that perspective as well. Thanks.
Thanks, Colette. All right, maybe if there's any other questions, now would be the time to get it in before we do a quick next steps close out. Not seeing any. Oh, there's Robert Stewart. So let's get Robert in, and then we'll move on to the closeout side.
Thanks, guys. And appreciate the other comments that are coming in here at the end, too. What I do want to stress is from the perspective of energy storage, there are investment decisions that are being made right now about generation within the province. Without a clear tariff around energy storage, investment decisions will be delayed for those projects specifically. And this means that without a fast and near-term decision on tariff treatment for storage, we are effectively making the decision to move forward with other generation types. So there is a bias within the current system towards certain thermal generation types, and this needs to be resolved in the very near term before these investments decisions are made. So I appreciate the comments from Lode, and this is partly why separating these I think is reasonable, and we can move forward with the energy storage tariff as quickly as possible.
Thanks, Robert. All right, let's move on then to next steps and close up.
All right, thanks, Jordan. And really thank you to all of our attendees today. We really appreciate your participation today. The candid conversations help us, you know, refine our thinking, and we learn a lot through this. So just thank you. We are looking for your stakeholder feedback on this session. Our comment matrix is available on our website. We're looking for that on or before January 12th. So you can find it at the path that's provided there. We are also going to conduct a Zoom poll just to get some feedback on some initial feedback on our session. So Carla will be launching that shortly. And if we go to the next slide, just to give you a heads up, our next session, so session 5, the one we've all been waiting for, we have that planned for February 25th next year. You can expect registration details to be available for that in January. And as we've alluded to today and talked about today, our purpose is to present and discuss the preferred rate design, including energy storage treatment, to talk about the mitigation options and path. And the goal is really around, you know, building that understanding and getting your feedback and input on that. The objectives are listed there. I'm not going to read them. We talked about most of them today. And I think that brings our session to a close. So if there are any remaining outstanding questions, we can take them now. You can contact us if you need to. And once again, thank you very much for participating today.
Not seeing anything come up. So thanks everyone for your participation. We'll start to close off and drop off. Bye for now.